welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back to a new week, and thanks for joining me for another episode. Organizational resilience, I think that is front and center for a lot of companies at the moment. And when we look at the human aspect, the most important aspect of any organization, words such as social sustainability and diversity, inclusion, equality, fairness, psychological safety, all of these elements are so fundamental to a resilient organization. You know, especially after coming out of the pandemic, and thankfully that is months and months behind us, what the pandemic taught us was that many of us took all these terms for granted. But when we were isolated, when we had to work from home, when communication became simply transactional, we understood the impact and the toll it took on almost everybody. So I'm very pleased to be joined by Bonnie Lo Kramen today on It's an Inside Job. She has just recently written a book, Staff Matters, People-Focused Solutions for the Ultimate New Workplace. And her book will have the official launch at the end of this month, at the end of February 2023. And the launching of this book could not have come at a better time, especially when all of these elements that I just spoke of are front and center for many companies right now. And so the conversation today is going to be diving deep into that book and exploring some of the chapters, some of the content that we can use. But the question still remains, who is Bonnie Lo Kramen? Well, she's an international speaker, trainer, and author. But before that, she worked as the personal assistant to Oscar-winning actress Olympia Dukakis for 25 years. And since 2010, Bonnie has been traveling the world teaching and speaking, 13 countries and 38 states to date. She's now a CEO herself, employs an assistant, and is globally recognized as one of the most respected leaders in the profession and an expert on workplace issues, especially those regarding assistants. Now, Bonnie is sought after to speak about building ultimate partnerships between executives and assistants. And in 2022, Bonnie made her TEDx debut with The Real Reasons People Quit. Well, you can find more about Bonnie in the show notes. But for now, let's slip into the stream and meet Bonnie Lo Kramen. Well, thank you, Bonnie, for joining me on the show. I really appreciate you showing up and being generous with your time. I thought we could begin the conversation by you introducing yourself and what you do.
Thanks so much for having me, Jason. I am Bonnie Lo Kramen. I am originally from New Jersey, live in Florida now. For 25 years, I worked as a personal assistant to a celebrity couple, Olympia Dukakis and Louise Ehrlich. And that experience pretty much launched what I'm doing now. It led to writing my first book, Be the Ultimate Assistant, and teaching and speaking all over the world. In a million years, I never thought that speaking about working as an executive personal assistant would take me to places like Dubai and Scotland, but it did. And that led to talking with so many, not only assistants around the world, but leaders and HR professionals and recruiters who really helped me understand that there was a lot that was being disconnected in the workplace. So for the last 7 years, I've been working on my second book called Staff Matters. In this meantime, I teach workshops, Be the Ultimate Assistant workshops, and I go into corporations and support assistants to build better and stronger and sustainable partnerships with their leadership. What I've come to find out, Jason, is that there is pitifully a small amount of training offered to leaders about how to manage a staff, and not so much education for the assistants either. So I'm of a mind that we can do a whole lot better in this workplace.
Thanks for that. I appreciate the introduction, because I think, you know, the heart and the scope of this podcast is to talk about resilience, and resilience shows up in so many, in so many variants. And so one of them is organizational resilience. And I think you said it so succinctly. It's about building strong, sustainable relationships. I mean, that goes to the heart of resilience in organizations, because if they're not strong and they're frayed at the edges, well, you're going to have a very fixed and brittle type of organization. And that brings us to your book. In a few days, you will be launching Staff Matters. And I really'd like to dive into that, because you were kind enough to send me a copy of the book, and it is 21 chapters. I mean, it's a hefty book, but it's not just theory. What I really liked about it was the pragmatics and the practical. I mean, a lot of tools, a lot of stories, a lot of quotes from experience. So it's not a book of just book knowledge. It's actually a book of experience knowledge. And that's what really appealed to me. I was wondering, could you maybe elaborate a little on what inspired you to write Staff Matters?
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, it's been more than 7 years in the making. I share that I had an aha moment in 2012 when I was in London and another speaker asked the audience the following question: how many of you feel well managed by your leaders? And from the back of the room, I watched a room of over 200 executive assistants, seasoned assistants, and how so few raised their hands. And I thought, you know, and the ones that did, it was some of them were, it was very reluctant or very, very lackluster, not with any real enthusiasm. And I thought that led me to think, what is going on here? What is going on? And that led understanding the data point that many people have repeated, and that is that the average age that a leader receives their very first training in managing people is not until age 46. That data comes from 2021, from a survey that was from leaders from all over the world. And so you don't have to be a math genius to figure out that most leaders are out of school more than out of their MBA programs, out of their, you know, whatever they've gotten their degree in, they've been out of school more than 20 years before they get their very first training in managing people. And so for me, that was an aha moment. It was like, oh, well, that explains it. There's a lack of education for leaders. And compounded with, Jason, when I speak with assistants all over the world, they share to me, yes, they see and hear everything. They have a front row seat for what's going on in a company. But what they also share is that there's real reluctance to tell the leaders and to tell HR what they are seeing and hearing. There is a genuine fear in the global workplace. And frankly, that was in play prior to the pandemic, and the pandemic has only made it more complicated because of the virtual and remote nature of the work. I mean, you have a psychology background. Surely we know that it's hard enough having a difficult conversation in person, face to face. I would argue that it's quite a bit harder for people over a webcam.
No, I'd agree, because I wrote an article a few months, well, it must have been a year ago, and something on proximity bias. And it's just that it's our natural tendency to favor those in the room face to face than those on screen. And there's, when we have meeting after meeting after meeting on Zoom or Teams or whatever it is, you know, the interaction will naturally become transactional. It's just like, what's the business? Because let's get down to it. And so you lose all the nuance of communication when you're not face to face. So I agree that the pandemic has just exacerbated the problem. And what I find kind of ironic, Bonnie, is that, you know, there's this huge focus on psychological safety where people can speak up. And so you almost have this sort of this polarization of what your book addresses in such explicit terms, so clearly and concisely.
Well, and then thank this, you.
And then this this drive or this motivation with a lot of organizations to drive psychological safety. My concern sometimes with psychological safety is that it just becomes management speak. So if we could just rewind back to the trailhead of this conversation, you said you were in London at a conference listening to another speaker, and he or she said, "What is how many of you are being well managed?" And that kind of triggered this cascade of thoughts. Can I ask you, from your experience, just to sort of start generally here, how would you operationally define well managed? If someone feels managed, how do they know that?
Right. And all of this is discussed in the book. Mm. When someone feels well managed, that means that A, they feel respected for their job. They were hired for a reason, a SME. Every person hired in a company is a SME, a subject matter expert in something, at least one thing. And a person who feels well managed feels respected for that role they're playing. They are given clear expectations. They are given regular feedback. There is accountability. There is transparency on a team. There is an awareness that a leader is committed to fair rules across the board, because let me tell you that the staff is fully, clearly aware when the rules are not fair. If leaders think that they don't, they're fooling themselves. That is those are the basics, is feeling respected and that they belong in an organization. Surely feeling well-managed is a part of that, is feeling fairly compensated for the role. And then the icing on the cake for a lot of staff, although it's become more important in this post-pandemic workplace, is the support for ongoing training, the investment. You know, if a leader is willing to, you know, plunk down several hundred dollars for a course or additional training, that sends a message to staffers that they're worth it, you know, that their leaders are willing to invest in them. And that sends a very strong message of respect and acknowledgement. So that's kind of the short laundry list. How does that sound to you?
That resonates with me completely. Because one of the main tenets that I pulled from your book is that people are not so, I mean, money is important, but it's the respect. At the end of the day, they want to show up to a workplace where, as you said, they are subject matter experts, or SME, right? SME, you said, where people are respected. Can I ask you, we all know what respect means, but in the context of this, what does it mean for respect? Like, if I was to come in and I had a manager, how would I know I'm feeling? I know I feel respected, but what is specifically going on? I mean, what is your advice to managers and leaders of all sorts?
I really go granular in this in the book, because no matter where I go all over the world, that word, respect, hits a nerve, a big one. That's what, in my view, is the number one thing that all staff wants, no matter where you are. No matter if you're the janitor, you want to be respected for being good janitor, you know? And so it becomes things that do not cost penny. Things like saying, "Good morning, Jason," as opposed to just walking in and going to your desk. It's about saying your name, saying it, pronouncing it correctly, caring that I know that your last name is pronounced a certain way versus another way. I've had assistants tell me that they've quit jobs because their leaders refuse to pronounce their names properly. It gets, there's nothing more personal than somebody's name. And so when leaders may think it's trivial, but it is so not. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No, I mean, it's just that the name is the sweetest word you can hear, right? And then when you say they consciously choose not to do that, I find that I'm a little flabbergasted to hear. I mean, it's so basic.
You know, some leaders view it as a joke. Like, they're just going to call her Susie, and she really wants to be called Susan. people have a very usually strong reaction to what they want to be called. Because seriously, there's nothing more personal. It doesn't cost a thing to say good morning, good evening, have a great night. You know, it's about simple courtesy. Some managers will say, oh, Bonnie, I don't have time for that. I have time to say good morning, Jason. Well, I'm here to tell you that as long as our workplace is populated by human beings, most of us need that. We need to, it is a show of respect. That is on a very basic level. Now, of course, respect has very broad, you know, there are so many ways to show respect for someone, and it's not the same for everyone, but it's using, oftentimes it's using words like please and thank you, as opposed to please get me that file versus get me that file, or Bonnie, you know, get it.
Yeah, I agree with that, because I mean, it's basic civility. I mean, and that's the whole thing. I think that the pandemic has reinforced in us, has highlighted, is that when we have our communications just become transactional about doing the business, and we forget about all the connective tissues that actually make social bonds enriching and fulfilling, in the sense, is that when we strip away the, as simple as it sounds, the basic civility of please, thank you, good morning, then it just becomes transactional. And there's something that it just feels like a hollowing out of a real relationships. I mean, we don't have to be best of friends, but we're working colleagues. Correct. And we're pulling hopefully in the same direction. Yes. On a project or a task or an objective. So I completely agree with you. Sometimes
what I tell my students is that we must, in the workplace, create a baseline. Baseline is we treat each other. Let me start here. Every person in their department, in their company, was hired for a reason. At some point, someday, might have been 20 years ago, somebody said, looked at a person's resume and said, we want you. You're hired. Okay, thank you. I'm joining the company. So on that level alone, there has to be respect for that. You know, that you might not know what that reason is, but the fact that they are employed by the company is worthy of just an assumption of we are going to respect each other as professionals, and then to treat each other professionally with mutual respect. You begin there. The workplace is no place for bullying and intimidating behaviors. We must begin with professionalism and mutual respect in our workplace. End of story.
Yeah, no. I concur. You know, when I'm in and out of organizations as a sparring partner or coach or what have you, you know, disrespect, some people might just get over it and just get down to the business. We pay you enough money, just do the job.
Yeah.
To some extent, yes, that's true, but that's looking at it at a very superficial level. If you look at the depth of this, disrespect is something we call social pain, and you know, from my discipline. And social pain is something that's actually linked to physical pain. So when people feel disconnected, disrespected, undervalued, not appreciated, that actually, it creates physical pain. So if that person was to actually take like an aspirin or what have you to deaden the pain, then that would go away. But unless the underlying reasons why that pain is showing up are addressed, such as civility, such as respect, and that pain will come back. And as you said, after a while, people will leave a company, not before the company, but because of the boss, he or she, what have you. They leave it because of their manager.
Correct.
And so I see so much of this, and that physical pain speaks volumes to having a psychologically unsound or unsafe environment. Is this what you've experienced from all the interviews you've done? I think you did, was it 1,200 interviews or something?
1,500. Part of my workshop is that I have one-on-one conversations with every student before they come. And I've been doing it for 12 years. It's actually one of my favorite parts of the workshop is we do it either by phone or by Zoom. And in those one-on-ones, Jason, I mean, you know what happens when people feel safe to say what's really on their mind. They will tell you everything. And what leaders need to know is that if people are walking around in fear and terror of, you know, losing their job or, you know, not being liked or whatever, or being judged in a negative way, they will tell them nothing or what they feel like the manager wants to hear. So, yeah, I've done a lot of interviews. And what I'm very aware of is that, yes, psychological safety, I have a chapter called Is It Safe? Yes, that is what staff wants to feel safe to be who they are, to actually, you know, have the runway to do their jobs. And as opposed to being micromanaged, that's the problem with micromanaging, is that people don't feel like they're trusted to do their work. So if leaders are looking for the reason behind the great resignation and quiet quitting, it all, for me, boils down to disrespect. And, you know, I want to circle back to something we were talking about earlier, is that in business school, if we agree that data is correct, that most leaders don't get their first training about managing people till age 46, then that would say that most curriculum in business school is not teaching future leaders what exactly is psychological safety? How do you help a person feel psychologically safe? So if that's true, then truly my hope is I do include that data and information in great detail in my book. And I'm so glad that you had such a positive response to it. My hope is that book becomes on the recommended reading list at business schools, because if they're not going to get it in the classroom, how about they get it from Staff Matters? And honestly, part of my goal is to cut future leaders to the chase on what is actually going to matter. You know, give it a try. Say good morning, Kathy, and see the reaction that happens. This is not trivial or silly to do. This is smart business to do. And unless somebody is told this, how will they know? So I have great empathy for leaders. I want them to have the answers. That's my point of view on that.
Staff Matters, is that an extension of what you teach in your workshops?
There's a lot at stake in this workplace. And so, yes, I mean, Staff Matters, it's people-focused solutions for the ultimate new workplace. I see in a post-pandemic world, I'm very optimistic because I feel like we have a great opportunity right now with all the upheaval that's gone on. You know, in the book, I make the point about, you know, we had 9/11, which threw the world into turmoil. And then we had the financial crisis of 2008, which again threw the workplace into turmoil. You know, and now we have the pandemic and the great resignation, and now it seems to be flipping the other way. So, I mean, it's not a mystery why people feel like they have whiplash, you know, about what's happening. Are we going back into the office? Are we not going back? How many days a week? You know, in a million years, people did not expect in February 2020 that there was going to be a time when most of the workforce was working out of their houses. I mean, that was unthinkable for so many. And you, as a psychologist, you know that people resist change. Human beings typically resist change.
Organizations, teams, people facing change is nothing new. It has been around as long as we've been around. But when organizations are trying to deal with situations to come up with novel ideas or approaches of how to mitigate or to come up with a contingency plan, well, sometimes we need to take an unorthodox approach. And that means to broaden the spectrum of our conversation, of who we pull in. And Bonnie speaks to the idea of increasing the diversity of that conversation. And sometimes that means taking an unorthodox approach. Bringing in different peoples into the dialogue from different parts of the company have different roles and responsibilities, from very high to very low. Because everyone has an experience, everyone can see the organization from their perspective, and nobody has a 100% oversight over everything that's going on, not even the top leaders. And so by creating an arena where we can hear diverse opinions, diverse voices from diverse parts of the organization, Well, that can lead to a dynamic solution, a dynamic way of adapting to a challenge. And at the end of the day, isn't that truly what organizational resilience is all about?
The irony in the assistant world, you know, my classes Be the Ultimate Assistant. The irony is that when the pandemic hit, the assistants of the world, in my view, were actually among the best equipped to handle what was going to happen. You know, in their minds, they were thinking, oh, okay, I have to prepare for maybe being out of the office 2 weeks. They weren't thinking it was going to be 2 months or 2 years, right? But it's the way assistants think. The assistants of the world think in not only do they have a plan A, but they have to have a plan B and a plan C. Like, oh, what if executive's flight gets canceled? Oh, what if that, you know, that change in the plan? So they are constantly like a tennis player where their brains must function in plan B, plan C, plan D. So when they were forced home, they were like, oh, okay, this is the change today. They had a much easier way of being resilient. To your point about this podcast, they were studies in resilience where many other people of our workplace were thrown more into turmoil than I think they were.
Yeah. And so I think that's what's your important point, because the pandemic was the great shakeup. I mean, there was obviously a lot of negativity, but what it also did, it was a lot of, I think, positive in the sense that it really highlighted, and which your book addresses, equality and diversity and inclusion and psychological safety and respect. And also, you know, whether it's a hybrid model, working from remotely or working face to face, it really shook up all of these terms. And they're not just terms, they're actually living, breathing connective tissue that forms each of us as human beings and connecting. And what your book seemed to me for like a confluence of all these ideas, and which you articulated, I believe was 21 chapters of all, and you address each of these points. When it comes to, you were talking about the executive assistants or personal assistants per se, and how they come up with contingency plans. Is there something that managers can learn from their mindset or their mentality to adapt to change and, you know, sometimes unexpected adversity?
That would be a big fat yes. Mm. You know, one of the premises of the book and why it's 21 chapters and almost 400 pages is that I broke the rules of book writing. You know, I often get asked, well, who is it for, Bonnie? Mm. And I like you, Jason, I have a lot of leadership management books in my library. Mm. And they're mostly about the leaders, but I wanted to put the whole staff under covers of one book. And so therefore, the actual words and stories are there from leaders, but they're also there from assistants and HR and recruiters. And my premise is that if we agree that the workplace is broken, certainly aspects of the workplace are broken, then no one of those groups alone can fix what's broken. They're going to have to, in this new workplace we've got, collaborate and cooperate in a way that they haven't before. And so when you ask me what leaders can learn from assistants, is they need to ask them. Mm. Chapter 4 is ask first. The people were hired. It's frustrating for me. Perhaps you hear that in my voice. The idea that companies painstakingly hire people, right? They spend a lot of time and money and energy in hiring people, not only for what the actual tasks, the transactional tasks that they're going to do every day, but hopefully they're being hired for what they know in their brains from all the experience they have, what they know and who they know. So what I know about the staff of the world is that they are carrying a lot of knowledge in those heads of theirs, and they see and hear everything, but their leaders, including HR, are not asking them what they know. It's astonishing. That's why one of the stories in the book is from that executive assistant from NASA. The one, do you remember that story? The one who'd been there for 25 years. And when George Floyd was murdered, the head leadership of NASA consulted her as part of the team deciding about what kind of programs are needed, what kind of public statement would be needed from NASA about that event. And how visionary, how radical was it to bring in someone who represented the staff conversation? So it's about asking their people. That's my advice for leaders is look around, take a fresh look at the people who are already on your payroll, and you have a gold mine there. You have an unbelievable golden resource in the people you've already hired.
And I see this in some companies. They run town halls, and the idea of a town hall is that everyone shows up, but they don't show up with their rank or their role or responsibilities, but they will table a topic, and it'll just be whatever, 10, 15, 20 human beings sitting around a table, a virtual table sometimes, and they just kick around ideas, and they go around the table and ask them, what do you think? You know, what that creates is a sense of buy-in. It creates a sense of ownership. Yes. It creates a sense of value and that I can contribute to this, even though I may have this rank and it's not the highest rank. But by creating this sort of this arena in which people can share ideas and share opinions, that's great, because that creates a bonding. That creates thing. Even though I'm at level one, I might not be level 10, but I can still contribute to the conversation about how us as an organization or company are moving forward. So I concur with what you're saying. When it comes to your book, How Staff Matters, I mean, how can it support leaders and HR to work with assistants better if we just kind of focus on the assistants?
The key to all of this, Jason, in moving forward in a better way is to start with job descriptions, because the complaint globally is that certainly this is true in the assistant world, but I suspect, and I have come to know it's true in other areas of organizations, is that staff are doing job descriptions that the job that they're doing every single day bears very little resemblance to the job description that they were hired to do. There's a disconnect there. Mm. And so 2021 was referred to as the year of the job description because, you know, the pandemic forced so many people to like, oh, we're not doing travel anymore. So let's have, you know, XYZ people get involved in this. Mm. So there's been this real volatility about job descriptions, and the time has come for everyone in an organization to have an accurate and detailed job description. And let's take a fresh look at where everybody's fitting. In the assistant world, for example, there are typically, historically, HR responsibilities that many assistants not only are great at, but that they would be excited to get involved with. It's not that they would have total responsibility. What I'm talking about, things like the interview process for not only assistants, but new executives. To have a representative from the assistant staff sitting in on those meetings, because these professionals come at it with different eyes, right? So an onboarding is another subject. Assistants happen to be some are great at onboarding people. You know, they're so organized. They just love that whole teaching aspect. And then speaking of teaching, some assistants happen to be super techie and they love the idea of teaching others what they know about whether it's Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook. And so it's not only that they are subject matter experts about the tech, they can actually be supportive of IT if they hold a lunch and learn and teach their top 10 tips in Outlook or whatever. So, the list really goes on and on. How about disaster planning? My goodness, the pandemic, between the pandemic and 9/11 and all these natural disasters like tsunamis and earthquakes, and my goodness, like we have extreme weather, companies are taking a fresh look at their disaster plans. Like, there's nobody I've ever met who thinks that we're done with these, you know, whether it's going to be a social health crisis, is there going to be another pandemic? When is there going to be, God forbid, another, you know, terrorist attack? You know, we hear about active shooter situations every day. Clearly, every company needs to have a really robust and a great disaster plan. And assistants happen to be great sources of information about those kinds of things. You know, what software do we use to reach our people? You know, so I think IT could be supported by assistants, and also HR in pandemic certainly shone a great light on how many things HR is responsible for. Frankly, Jason, I think the time has come for company leaders to acknowledge that there needs to be a restructure of who's doing what in companies.
I think, as you said, you know, when it comes to disaster or some unexpected uncertainty, and they're talking and they're tabling that an issue as to what is a response or what kind of plan B should we have for this, you know, bringing people from different sectors, different responsibilities and professions into that conversation within an organization. And exactly, executive assistants or PAs or whatever you classify these professionals as, you know, part of their job is to actually think about contingency plans, how to mitigate risk when it comes to their particular manager or their executive that they're working with to help smooth out their day. So there is a certain mindset. There's probably a certain kind of set of questions they ask themselves, maybe automatically, that could be part of the question set that could help to come up with contingency plans for whatever they're planning this organization. Is that something that you're speaking to?
Oh my goodness, yes. And it's not the same for everyone. So on a staff of say 10 assistants, not everybody is, you know, compelled by, you know, putting their minds on a disaster plan, for example. But chances are there are one or two who would love to be involved in that effort. You know, there's a lot of attention being given right now to diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. ERGs, employee resource groups at companies, and assistants are wonderful sources of information for that kind of thing. But it's not the same for everybody. So what it requires is a conversation with individual people. You know, so Shelley, what's interesting to you now? And they call them stay interviews. They're annual reviews. It's a check-in with staff to see, how are you doing? What is your current job description? Are you happy with that job description? Is there any area you want to learn more about? Is there something that you see that you think we ought to be working on? That process takes time. And what it first takes is knowing that it's important to do. And I'm here to tell you what I promise every leader is that your staff knows a great deal more than they're sharing, because nobody's asking them what they think.
I guess in a sense, although it's not unorthodox, it is unorthodox for a lot of leaders to think about tapping into potentials that they haven't thought about before, you know, those resources, those experiences, those knowledge to contribute to whatever topic is at hand, and maybe a very burning issue within a particular organization. And to tap for different perspectives can shine a light. It could be just one sentence they say that opens, let's call it a positive Pandora's box, where all of a sudden there's a floodgate of different ways of approaching something. Not that all ideas will float, some will sink. But within that deluge of different ideas and perspectives, maybe there's something that sticks that could actually help that company deal with a certain conundrum or dilemma that they're facing.
100%. I give solid examples in the book of things to consider. One of my favorite leadership books is Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In. And she shared a story about how when she joined the team at Facebook, she was the only female in the room of top executives. And it wasn't until she joined the group that The Facebook parking lot got some parking spaces for pregnant women.
What is your advice? I mean, you've been in the game for many years and you've talked to a lot of people globally in different corporations. I mean, what advice would you give to a woman who may be the only female on a team? I mean, what is your advice to her?
Well, when she joins, my advice for female leaders, of which there are still far too few, is to seek mentorship from other female leaders who she respects and admires. Because there's a saying out there, you can't be it if you can't see it. And many female leaders, the only role models they have to emulate are men. And some of those men who they're emulating, it doesn't necessarily work when that's in play. I also advise female leaders to tap into their female staffers for sources of support and acknowledgement. But it begins with the interview process. Like, why does a female leader want to join a particular organization in the first place? My advice to her would be to really vet out the attitude of senior leadership. You know, is she a token or is she really there to bring value? There's, you know, an article from the LA Times that I quote, you know, about the tech companies. It was from some years ago, but the headline was "Why Women in Tech Are Leaving in Droves," and that the article made the point that tech companies were trying desperately to attract women there, but that the reality for women was that they had to prove themselves 2, 3, 4 times more than a man would in order to get any kind of advancement, and it was so demoralizing and so, you know, defeating that they ended up quitting after a period of time. We need to do better. And it has to do with raising awareness about the bias that exists and to do it in a way that we need allies. We absolutely, the females of leadership in the world need very much male allies to see how valuable that they are. And that's not just that's not lip service. What the data shows is that diversity on teams, whether it's leadership teams or staff teams, is a stronger one, more creative one. Diversity of age, diversity of gender, diversity of ethnicity really contributes to how vital a team is. It's kind of, it can be rather boring if everybody is the same. Certainly, would everybody agree? Yeah, I suppose that. But I have been on teams where some of the most exciting ideas come from a person who you don't necessarily expect or someone who hasn't been asked before. And I just think that's what makes the workplace such an interesting place.
Yeah, I think, you know, living in the Nordics, you see there is a greater emphasis and focus on equality, diversity, and inclusion. It's far from perfect, but from a North American perspective, living here in the Nordics, I see a large difference between things that I feel the Scandinavian countries are a couple of steps ahead of where we, us North Americans, are. But it's good that there is the conversation. And I think your book is a good timing for this, because as I said, it's a book that is a confluence for all of these different subjects and topics. I was wondering,
Jason, may I ask you, why do you feel that the Nordic countries, I have my own theory on this, but why do you think the Nordic countries are ahead of the rest of the world in equality and diversity and inclusion? May I know?
Well, again, this is just from my opinion. You know, since I've started this podcast and I also run my company Mind Talk, I talk to a lot of leaders, both females and males, and I can see that this is a conversation that is not in sort of on the back burner. This is front and center, and it's become a very dominant subject on a lot of different levels, a lot of different playing fields. And every year they have in April here, April 19th, 20th, they have something called the She Conference. And it's just that it's talking about all that, but it's not saying that it's trying to be inclusive for males, females, races, genders, what have you, the whole gambit to bring about it. And so again, this is from my perspective. I see that this conversation is talked about quite often. Again, this is anecdotal. When I work with clients, I see that this conversation is much more frequent. And I see it's not just the conversation. I see it translated into actions and efforts that are becoming part of the DNA being weaved into a lot of the organizations I work with. Mm-hmm. Again, there's still a lot of improvement that needs to be made. And I think your book will highlight a lot of these points.
Yeah. And again, I would concur with you, Jason, that I don't know that we're ever going to get to be perfect here, but the effort, my view on the Nordic countries is that, you've had a history of many female leaders in the most powerful positions. And so when you have that kind of diversity at the top, that contributes to having this conversation.
You know, there's a great quote that Bonnie said. She said, their staff knows a great deal more than they are sharing because nobody is asking them what they think. And sometimes diversity is just that. Diversity is easy to bring to people into the fold, but inclusion, well, that takes a little more effort, a lot more effort actually. And that is to ask people what they think, to tap into their knowledge and their experiences, their ideas and their opinions, because they bring a lot to the table. Yes, they specialize and are experts in their particular field, but because of their field, because of where they sit in the company, they may have so much more to contribute. And sometimes it only takes one sentence that can open up a whole basket full of ideas, a whole world of possibilities of how to deal with a conundrum, uncertainty, change, or challenge that the organization is facing. And so in the last part of our conversation, Bonnie talks about some companies that she highly respects that have made this leap, such as Salesforce and Hilton. But you know what? I'll let Bonnie speak to the rest of that. All right, Bonnie, take it away.
In my book, I was on the search for the companies that are doing it well. And again, they're not perfect, but they're trying. They're absolutely trying it. So some of the companies that and nobody paid me to say their names or anything in the book, I would point to Salesforce as one of them. Mark Benioff, as the CEO, he was committed openly, like on the TV show 60 Minutes, to wage equity between women and men. His head of HR discovered that there was a serious disparity between what men were being paid at Salesforce and women. And he put millions of dollars into leveling it. And I mean, that's to be admired for sure. Another one is Hilton. When the pandemic hit, I loved the story about how Hilton committed to not letting anybody go. And you know what happened to the hospitality business.
Yeah.
And not only did they, keep people on at their salary and keep health insurance, but he partnered with the head of American Express because of the problem about first responders, right? Nurses, doctors not being able to go home because they needed to, they were afraid to bring the virus home to their families.
Yeah.
So Hilton collaborated with American Express to provide 1 million hotel rooms to doctors and nurses and firemen and first responders, which I thought was, just so responsive and real. So I point to them as companies doing well. Yeah. And there's many more, which I point to in the book.
I think
life insurance in New York, they gave out gift cards to staffers just without any strings attached in order to outfit their offices you know, do you need a new monitor? Do you need a new desk chair? Do you need a new light? Like, here's $500. Do what you need to do. Like, that's cool.
Yeah. And I think your book, it dives into, I mean, you parse apart the individual topics in 21 different chapters, giving examples and quotes and suggestions. And, you know, whether it's respect or disrespect, whether it's fairness. And one of the things I really liked about the book is where you've talked about the unmentionables, where, you know, some of those unsaid undercurrent of things that happen in corporations. I was wondering, is there one that kind of really stood out to you that you'd like to share with my listenership? Something that stood out to you that we should address?
That I'm actually wondering which one stood out for you.
For me, I think as we talked about just pre-interview, one of them that stood out to me, it wasn't a company mentioned, but I think her name was Kelly or something, where the manager, she was in a meeting with a bunch of leaders and the manager had said something to her, "Are you stupid? Didn't you get it?" And what that revealed to me, and then when she gave some feedback, I guess a little time afterwards, mm-hmm. It says, "I found that very offensive. I was hurt by that." I'm just paraphrasing now.
Right.
That he was kind of clueless to that idea. He's like, "What? Oh, I didn't mean it like that." And it's just like, this social antennas to have that conversation, to be cognizant of how you treat people and that civility and how you communicate.
Yeah.
For me, it was kind of shocking. I mean, I work with this stuff inside out every day, but when I read that, it's like, really? This
is real life.
Happened?
And
yeah.
Kim, you're telling the story of Kim and
Kim. Sorry, Kim.
What's so powerful about the story is that when she confronted her CEO, the CEO was, as you say, sincerely clueless, sincerely oblivious about the way that kind of language was landing. Mm. So that tells me that the leader, the CEO, was so consumed. You know, people are about themselves, right? Mm. That we're caught up in our own head. And I've asked leaders, why are some leaders so intimidating and abusive? Mm. And one actually said, "Well, Bonnie, how do you think I'm going to get things done around here? Of course I have to be hard on them. Of course." Mm. And we know that that it might seem effective in the short term, but in the long term, it is not. Kim, who that was the assistant's name, mm-hmm. she ended up saying to her CEO, "You know, I'll go back into that meeting, but if you do that again, mm-hmm. I'm leaving." And CEO said, "Oh, okay." Just so she came back and when they talked, she said, I'm sorry, I'll be better." Mm-hmm. And she was better, but not all the way better. And Kim ended up leaving in a few months after that. But she felt very good that kind of abuse had been going on for quite a while. And that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, this gives me an opportunity to say, you know, perhaps anyone listening to this can relate to a time when they have felt intimidated or abused in the workplace. And just like Kim does, she remembers the day. She remembers what she was wearing. She remembers the time of day. She remembers who else was in the room. We remember these things vividly. And my students say they remember it not only for the week it happens or the month it happens, or they remember it forever. It can be traumatic.
It took her a lot of courage and to face her fear to bring up that subject. And so if we bring it down to the nuts and bolts here, you know, a lot of people can be on the receiving end of such incivility. I mean, maybe this is not so easy to answer, but what is your recommendation to people to find the courage and the confidence to have that very difficult conversation, especially when it's an authority figure within that organization, which adds a whole layer of complexity? I mean, I know I'm asking you for a very brief answer, but what would be some of your advice to that individual to speak up, to share some feedback in a difficult situation?
Well, I have done a great deal of research into this and spoken with many psychologists, and in part, not only did it happen to me personally, But in our classes and Be the Ultimate Assistant workshops, there's no chance to work at a very high level and be super productive if you are sitting there being sad, angry, demoralized, depressed, because of these toxic behaviors. So I believe life is too short to deal with this. My advice starts with the interview process, to understand the culture of a company and to say things during the interview, such as, I feel like I'd love to work at this company. Can you talk me through how the company culture is here? And what you need to know about me is that I'm a super hard worker, but what I can't handle is yelling and abusive bullying. So I'd love to know how that is handled here. Something to that effect, to let the interviewer kind of be on notice about a person's beliefs on the issues of respect. I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And then when they are confronted in the workplace, the move is to document it, first of all, but to not run to HR like first recourse. It's about getting the person alone, saying, could I have 10 minutes? I have something on my mind. It's about being calm, clear, direct. Jason, I need to talk with you about what happened in the meeting yesterday. I'm not sure you realize it. When you said that to me, XYZ thing, it really was offensive to me. And I want to work really well with you. That needs to be the last time you speak to me like that. And I realize you might not know that it landed like it did, but I'd be very interested in knowing what you think about that, Jason.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I think feedback is necessary. I mean, without managing expectations, whether it's upwards, downwards, laterally, vertically, I think it's very important. And in this case, let's say it's someone's already deep in the job and they've, long ago had the interview process. And there is that. There's going to be those very few percentages where it's not going to fly. There's always that 2-5% where it's, you may have to leave the company. But in a lot of cases, like was it Kim and her boss? He or she, the boss, was completely oblivious to what he was saying or what she was saying to Kim that made her feel anything. And unless Kim found the courage to talk about it, it's very important. And so part of my experience is before you have that conversations, write down your thoughts, write down the emotions, process what's going on. Because as you said, a lot of these incidents people remember for a lifetime. Well, because it's emotionally salient, that's basically how memory works. And if it's something emotionally positive or negative, in this case, negative, it's going to resound. It's going to be part of their mental DNA moving forward. But when it comes to that, I think it's so important for a person, as you said, directly but diplomatically tell them what was the behavior and how it impacted them and what they would like to see moving forward. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, if it's a decent relationship, a working relationship, then the person will say, okay, that was not my intention. I apologize for that. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can fix it. And if it doesn't go that way, then maybe that's a good signal that there's a pattern of interaction that you might have to find the courage to find a new place to work or another part of the company. And it's never easy and it's never black and white. It never gets easy, but I think it gets easier to have those conversations when you slowly build up the confidence to see how you react and what the fallout is. That's my perspective and my anecdotal experience.
Well, and I think these experiences are cumulative, meaning that once a person musters the courage to have the conversation and it goes relatively well, that gives them the strength to do it another time and another time. And the thing is, in Kim's case, to my memory, she had been dealing with these kind of behaviors for over a year. And in my view, I don't want it to take a year. I want it to take a month at max, to give a person a chance. I don't want it to last a year. I want it to last not even a day, really, yeah. But you know, we give people the benefit of the doubt. We let people slide. We say, oh, that's the way he is. Or, you know, we give them excuses. But the reality is bullying has no place in the workplace. And you correctly point out that in my classes, most adults can understand how, does it make sense that a leader would actually be clueless and oblivious over the behavior about saying somebody's stupid? Is it possible? And they pretty much agree that, yeah, it's possible for them to be clueless and oblivious. So then the question is, how do you make somebody who's clueless and oblivious not clueless and oblivious? We have to tell them. And I'm so gratified that so many of the people who've been in my workshops and audiences have taken that leap, and because it takes incredible courage to do it, but it's about finding the words. So in our workshops, we talk about the words to say, and in the book, In Staff Matters, I give people the words to say. I want all staff to have the tools they need to build something better, and frankly, not only for themselves, but for their kids and the grandkids. I know you have children. I do. I have grandkids. I don't want my granddaughter bullied or sexually harassed. I want her paid properly. And if these things happen, I want her to have the words to say to make it stop immediately.
I know, you know, for me to have this interview was very important because I understand the relevancy of your book because I have two daughters and they're coming up in the game. I have a wife who's a professional, works for a big bank here in Norway.
Yeah.
And so everything affects them. And plus, you know, half of my clients are professional women. And I see a lot of the challenges you speak of are things that not just at the executive assistant level, but this could be at the C-suite level too, I see. So these
100%.
All these challenges you speak of, Bonnie, they're indicative of at every level. I'm just appreciative of your time. I was wondering, is there any last advice or tips you would like to leave with my listeners that from Staff Matters or from the training workshops you run?
Thank you. You know, I want to leave your audience knowing that I have great empathy for leaders. I am not about, you know, women versus men or all male leaders are bad. They are not. And I know that it's a tough gig. It's a tough, tough gig to be a leader. So I have tremendous empathy and concern for offering all leaders, men and women, tools for how to do better in this workplace. So my final thoughts are to approach today, any given day, as a new day, a fresh opportunity to take a look at people who are already on your payroll and to talk with them. And in order to leverage them and understand how much more value that they bring to the company, if only they're asked. And I believe that that exercise will be time very well spent. They are a golden resource for you. And I have met them all over the world. And so there are lots of things that are going unsaid in this workplace because people are fearful. So I am urging leaders to listen to the quiet and urge your staff to say the quiet things out loud.
I like that. Listen to the quiet.
Companies will benefit.
Listen to the quiet. It's a perfect quote. Staff Matters. When will that book be available, Bonnie?
Oh my gosh, at long last, it's being published February 28th, 2023. It'll be on Amazon and Goodreads and all the places that people buy books. It'll be an ebook and soft cover immediately and then audiobook in a few months.
Ah, okay. That was my interest, audiobooks, because I've read the book, but I also like listening to books on my long runs. So it's perfect.
Okay. Well, then you'll get to hear my voice talking about these ideas, which I'm so happy to know how much they resonated with you and what you're thinking the impact can be on leaders, because that's the point, isn't it?
At the end of the day, it is to create better workplace. And I think half the battle is just educating, making people cognizant of the ongoing issues that some people feel. And sometimes, unless you are that gender or of that race or of that what have you, you might be just oblivious. And it's not because you're consciously oblivious. It's just because maybe your life doesn't take you into those spheres of experience. And so it's to have that diplomacy and directness to have these hard conversations without everyone sort of becoming so polarized that where we can sit down and have a conversation about these things. And your book does it a huge justice to those conversations of diversity, inclusion, gender issues, equality, everything else, respect, disrespect.
Well, you know, those are the issues that are slowing people down, Jason, slowing them down and stopping them dead in their tracks. And if there's any final point to finish on, is that that's not serving leaders or companies. But if you have people who are slowed down by any abuse or intimidation of any kind, you're not getting the best work out of those people, right? It's not possible to work at a very high level if you are feeling any of those negative emotions that can be paralyzing. And so we can do better. That's what I think. We can know better, and we can do better if we have the facts.
I agree. And I think that's a great point to end on. Bonnie, thank you very much for being on the show. Your book, Staff Matters, is launching February 28th of this year, 2023, with the audiobook soon to follow in a couple of months.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason.
No worries, Bonnie. Anytime. I'd actually like to get you on again, maybe near the end of the year, to see how things have played out, if your book has helped.
I'm game. Yeah, let's do it.
Great. Thanks, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that was the passionate, knowledgeable Bonnie Lowe-Kramen. She's the author of the new book that launches at the end of this month, Staff Matters, People-Focused Solutions for the Ultimate New Workplace. And Bonnie, a personal thank you from me to you for spending time, a generous amount of your time today, to share your knowledge and experience and your know-how. It really meant a lot, and thank you for sending me a copy of the book. I thought it was pragmatic and practical and very tool-based. And I think, as I said at the top of this show, it's perfect timing for what organizations are facing right now and the conversations that's being had in meeting rooms across the planet. Thank you, Bonnie. I really appreciate it. Well, folks, I will leave all of Bonnie's contact information in the show notes, and you will also find the link to her previous book and a link to her new book. Well, folks, that brings us to a tail end of another show, and I thank you for showing up, and I hope you spread the message. And you can do that by a call to action. If you could rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast and to this episode, that would be great. And if you could recommend to two friends, two family, and two colleagues the podcast, you'd be doing me a big favor to spreading the word. But until next week, until we speak again, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.